Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I am your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Jeremy Black. Jeremy is a professor of history at University of Exeter in England, and he is the author of many books. Today we're speaking about one of his most recent, England in the Age of Shakespeare, Indiana University Press, just published in 2019. Jeremy, many congratulations on the book, and welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and perhaps what you've been working on recently?
I'm coming towards the close of my career at Exeter, and I am writing and researching quite actively. I still would like to think that although the body is creaking, the mind is active. And England in the Age of Shakespeare is the first of what I hope will be a number of books. In fact, having gone through the readers, the academic readers, Indiana has just accepted my England in the Age of Austen, which will eventually come through. That's Jane Austen, obviously. And after that, I'd like to do Dickens and Doyle and Christie. So there's a number of them. And what I'm trying to do in these books is to bring the perspective of a historian. I don't claim any particular insight as a literary scholar, but I think it's useful to have the contextualization brought up to date, applied to the works, and the works applied to the contextualization. And that's what I've tried to do with this Shakespeare. As you know, Crawford, I also write other things, but I write them in strands. So this is the particular strand we're talking about today.
Very good. Now, you've been interested in fiction for a long time, haven't you? You've worked in James Bond before, for example. How do you as an historian engage with literary sources, and how do they help you think about historical themes?
That's a fascinating question. I've always been interested in texts. I suppose I get that going right back to being an undergraduate. In fact, before being an undergraduate, obviously, some of those texts are fictional and some of them are not intended as fictional. As you may know, I've written three books on the history of the English press, which in fact is a form of textualism. And indeed, some of the writers of newspapers, one can think of Henry Fielding or Charles Dickens, also wrote fictional works. So I'm not sure I would necessarily see a stark divide. And indeed, the noted 18th century phrase, a history, as in the history of Tom Jones, can relate just as much to fiction as it can to what is intended as nonfiction. And I've discussed that in my recent book, or last year, I think it came out, Indiana published it, on attitudes to history in the 18th century. So I find fictional texts that are explicitly intended as fictional interesting, but of course most fictional texts are not. I mean, I've just been reading Dombey's Son, or rereading it this morning, and Dombey's Son, you could argue, well, it's obviously a work of fiction, but Dickens is clearly intending it as a Condition of England novel, and therefore it's not simply a work of fiction.
Now, The very interesting juxtaposition you have in this book, England in the Age of Shakespeare, between social historical themes, formats, and literary sources. How does all of that come together? Who is this book for? Who's your ideal reader?
Well, I think most people are interested in Shakespeare or have seen Shakespeare. So anybody that's interested in Shakespeare and would like to know about the context, that is part one. But part two, linked to that, as you know, because you've read the book, there is a lot of quite tight writing in which the text is interwoven with what is going on. So, you know, it's not only that the text illuminates Shakespeare, Shakespeare is illuminated by the texts. So I would hope anybody interested in the history or literature of the period would find it valuable. It's not intended for theoretical critics. I have to say that I'm sure that they offer a lot to those who like that, but I'm afraid I'm a nuts and bolts historian. I'm concerned with, as it were, both what happened and how contemporaries understood what happened. I'm not really interested very much in what people who, you know, produce, let's say, 20th or 21st century literary theory, which would have meant very little to contemporaries, have to say about that. And since this is a religious channel, let me make the point that most modern critics are writing outside a religious framework. And I think that makes it very difficult for them to understand the culture in which Shakespeare's works are impacted. Or indeed, one might say the same thing for Jane Austen, or indeed for Charles Dickens. I don't mean that all writers in the past were necessarily devout, but I mean that they were writing within the context of a society in which devotion and religious motivation, religious causation were regarded as very significant.
I think that's a very astute comment. I think in the Shakespeare criticism I've read over the years, teaching Shakespeare, a lot of it is very helpfully informed by early modern theological debates, but some of it, I think, just gets it completely wrong.
Yeah, I fear so.
How did you go about putting this book together? There's a vast range of reference here, Jeremy, through the Shakespeare canon. How did you actually write this book?
Well, I mean, you know, I've been interested in Shakespeare for a long time. I remember as a little boy first having to be that great role of the wall in Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, an epic performance.
It's a very important role.
Extremely important role. I'm afraid I'm not a very relaxed person, so it's very difficult for me to see something or to read something without trying to once think about resonances and interpretation. And I suppose what you have got is the distillation of that in the book. I mean, obviously, to write it, I reread a lot of literature, Shakespeare, his contemporaries, and a lot of criticism. But, you know, it's been with me for a long time. I was very fortunate. I was taught English at sixth form level by a very good teacher, a man called Michael Fitch, and Michael wanted all of his top set to be able to go to read history at Cambridge, where he'd read it. And therefore, he delayed all the A-level set text the second year of the two-year A-level course, and we spent the first year on a grand tour through English literature, of which one entire term was devoted to Shakespeare and his contemporaries, people like Kidd and the Spanish Tragedy, people like Webster, but primarily Shakespeare. And I think that was very important for me. I mean, I gravely disappointed him by not applying to read English at Cambridge, but nevertheless, I benefited enormously from his teaching and his legacy.
So, the book that that we're talking about today, England and the Age of Shakespeare, is it about Shakespeare's world or the world as Shakespeare saw it?
Both, and indeed, I would have thought the best of the chapters is the very it's the only one that's important, but because it's actually, it was the hardest to write, the imagination of the age. And I deliberately put that chapter at chapter one, because I think the imagination of the age is more important to explaining the plays and their likely reception than discussing, shall we say, co-production.
Now, I was struck by that chapter enormously. Partly, I think, because it deals with issues to do with apocalyptic and millennialism, which we might talk about in a second, but also because it really reframes the project in unexpected ways. We begin this chapter and we're launched into a discussion of witchcraft and the occult. Why did you decide to frame the book in that kind of way?
Well, I think that one of the points I'm trying to argue is that in Shakespeare, there is the real presence of evil. Again, incidentally, I think the same thing can be seen in both Austen and Dickens. I think evil is a presence in a way that for modern thinkers that's often very difficult. But to me, the 16th century, in some respects, is still quite Augustinian. The struggle between good and evil being very central there. I mean, Shakespeare obviously brings it on stage, but it also can be seen in the way that his characters are tempted to what he clearly presents as wrong. So I think that there is a morality there alongside many other elements. They're not simply morality plays, but there is a morality there. And I was trying to discuss that. I was trying to explain the nature of that. Again, as I said, to a modern society, for whom, you know, there are many modern readers who are and listeners who are devout in terms of modern day religion, but 16th century religion was 16th century Christianity is not the same as modern Christianity, and the same is true of other religions. And I think there can be a very ahistorical failure to understand that.
I think we should bring you to Northern Ireland sometime, Jeremy, for a little tour of the 16th century. nevertheless, there is also in that chapter a very evocative description of the apocalyptic mood of the 17th century. Everything seems ultimate. Everything seems imminent. What's going on that makes that so?
Well, there are a whole host of factors there. There are both material world, and you know, so we're talking about the end of the 16th century, economic expansion, demographic expansion. We're talking about really quite parlous socioeconomic circumstances, particularly in the 1590s, 1600s and 1610s, the end of the so-called phase A of the early modern economy and the beginning of the phase B. So those both material things, but there is also spiritual dimensions, and the second are not simply dependent on the first. I don't wish to offend any Marxists listening, but that's a sort of, you know, Marxism is as much a belief structure as an analysis. So the discussion of witchcraft, which I talk about at some length, reflects an element of psychological crisis, spiritual crisis. And then, of course, there are the very anxious aftermath of both the Protestant Reformation and the Catholic Counter-Reformation, which are matters which divide families, communities, and, you know, also produce, as it were, the cosmic shock. What does the afterlife mean in this context? What happens to ancestors? You know, the sort of image, very clearly the case with in Hamlet and the Ghost. What is the meaning of meaning when the church, which used to mediate that in terms of unchallenged authority, is suddenly very much challenged? And I think those are problems that created a multifaceted spiritual crisis.
Now, in your book, we see other kinds of crisis as well, don't we? You describe very helpfully changes in the urban landscape, changes in the rural landscape. Is Shakespeare best understood as an urban or a rural writer?
That, again, is a fascinating question. One of his great strengths is that he was both. He had a rural background, although bear in mind what we might think of as a small town, Stratford-upon-Avon was still a town. But he had a background in a small context in which you can readily walk into what we would call a rural environment, and one in which the annual rhythms, things like the harvest, are tremendously important. But he then spends much of his life living in a metropolis where there are sort of non-natural sounds and smells and sights which force through a whole different range of experience. The way that the night is lit by, you know, by lights, flames outside, in a way that would just simply not be captured in the countryside. So where the stars are the principal lighting, the moon at night. So I think that his range of experience reflects both, and indeed you can find that much in his language.
How does Shakespeare represent changes that were taking place in London or in England generally in his lifetime?
Well, there are, I mean, for example, in King Lear, I think you can see a sense of the immiseration that comes from rural rural disruption. I think that's quite clear. But a lot of his plays are not about social change. They're more about, insofar as he's considering society, society as a backdrop for human drama.
A lot of his plays, of course, are historical. You know, he shifts action and perhaps even consideration of contemporary themes or worries and projects that onto different kinds of historical canvases. How do you rate him as an historian?
Yes, the first point, you're absolutely right. I mean, for example, his fear of the mob, or whatever you mean by the mob, or the propensity of crowds to unattractive political disturbance is very present in things like Julius Caesar or Coriolanus. Not that the elite are necessarily depicted as acting in an attractive fashion. As an historian, well, he has his sources. I mean, Holinshed most famously, and he reads actively in the classics. I mean, I would say that by the standards of the age, he is writing and offering a relatively moralized history, which is of enormous interest to this day. It resonates. Had he been taking part in a sort of antiquarianism, it wouldn't have been so interesting. I mean, you know, obviously there are aspects of it which we today would know are wrong, I mean, or simplistic or questionable, or where we are aware of different approaches. But then Shakespeare is not, thankfully, trying to address a history seminar, and it has to be said that the way in which some historians are offering a politicized version of the past at the moment scarcely suggests that fiction is absent from the world of scholarly academe.
We might come back to that point in a second. Well, just on this point of politics, how do you see Shakespeare interacting with the politics of his own day? Is he a propagandist? As he writes about, for example, the shift from Elizabeth to James and his movement of genre across that period as well, how do you see him contributing to political discussion in his own time?
Well, I try and discuss that in the book. There's been a wealth of excellent scholarship on Shakespeare vis-a-vis, for example, the Earl of Essex, and, you know, trying to capture the extent to which he was committed to particular factional outputs. I mean, I can't really add to that. What I do try and do is link up the moral perspective he offers to the account of a society which he depicts as fragile, and therefore the very fragility of society means that evil intention by individuals or groups, but he's principally concerned with individuals, evil intention by individuals in positions of prominence can be terribly disruptive. And his account of course, English history from sort of Richard II onwards is one in which sin, evil, ambition, all of them are proved to be hopelessly disruptive and to cut across normal human relationships, as in son killing father, father killing son, which is depicted in Henry VI, or, you know, the fate of the children depicted in Richard III. These are attempts to very much present history in a moral term, which would have meant a lot in those terms. And of course, you know, theology was in many senses seen in the same way. It's worth bearing in mind that in terms of sermons, the Book of Kings was tremendously important in the early modern period, and that very much presents the kings as moral agents and therefore as open to all sorts of sins such as ambition and greed, as well as acting as the arm of God, or in the case of Christian thinker, the arm of the church, you know, the church militant, in effect. So I think that morality is central to the politics. And I think to take politics out of a moral context is to produce an account which is of limited value to understanding it in that period. It's both drama, but it is drama that has meaning. The difficulty today is that so many modern productions they are offering you a meaning which would have been meant very little to Shakespeare's contemporaries and which tell you more about the image of the present and the understanding of the modern director, you know, sort of Hamlet produced as a sort of disquisition on Brexit, that kind of rubbish.
Well, we might come back to the question of reception in just a moment, Jeremy. But for now, if we think about some of the material you footnote, for example, you engage very well and very extensively with that tendency in, I suppose, post-1970s Shakespeare criticism to project various kinds of political Shakespeare. Is the Shakespeare you reconstruct in this book much more of a conservative figure than many of these critics have suggested?
Yes, I suppose he is, and I'm trying to do the same thing in the Austen very much. I think in the case of Jane Austen, it's easier because, of course, she left a unpublished history of England in which her views were, shall we say, rather bluntly offered. And we also have correspondence from her, of course. In the case of Shakespeare, it's harder. And there is always the difficulty of distinguishing sort of the author from the characters and the speeches they are given. Equally so, I think it's fair to say that many authors provide a fairly clear-cut guide to what your response is supposed to be. I mean, you don't go into King Lear without a sense of the goodie and the baddie. And, you know, we would not take the same view of bastardy as is taken by 16th century or early 17th century moralists. But we have to be aware that you're often given quite strong hints by the depiction of characters as to what you're supposed to think about them. I mean, you know, I dare say there's probably some brilliant theorist out there I haven't read who's trying to show that Iago is the hero of Othello, but I don't find that terribly convincing. You know, I'd prefer to stick with what Shakespeare offers us.
Well, as we think about what Shakespeare offers us, is your opinion that he is a nice man?
I really wouldn't know that. I don't know enough about him as an individual because I think in many senses he's a pre-biographical figure. Mm. I find it fascinating the extent, having written biographies myself, I've done George III, George II, and Pitt the Elder, I find it very, one's always aware of the difficulties of evidence. So George III is much easier than George II because with George II we have very little, very few letters indeed, whereas with George III we have a plethora written in his own hand. To a great extent, prior to Pepys, I would say most 17th century characters are pre-biographical, and that doesn't mean you can't make comments about them, and we've been discussing them, but it does mean that in terms of what you might call a personal characteristic, you know, we can comment on their views. You can comment on the views of John Fox. It's much harder to discuss, for example, whether somebody is nice, because that carries with it all sorts of implications. Does he depict his characters in a nice way? I mean, what I would say is that he wants his comedies to end either well or in a bittersweet way. He doesn't want to end them with a savage, sardonic look at what has happened. So if you want to use that as the term nice, yes, then he is nice. But I'm not sure I find the term nice terribly helpful. And I mean, I wouldn't go as far as my use of the word charming when I use the word charming to my close friends to describe somebody else who is totally insincere. So, you know, one has to be very careful. Nice has different meanings to different people.
As does Brexit. You mentioned Brexit a few moments ago, and there's a chapter in the book, of course, on Shakespeare's representation of European contexts. Is he a European? How interested is he in life on the continent?
Well, is he a European? He's writing in the background of a European culture, a culture which encompassed a lot of Europe, namely that of the classics, and the culture comes all of it, of course, and also, of course, Christianity. So from those points of view, he's drawing on a common culture which isn't limited to England. Does he know much about continental Europe? Well, most people didn't in that period, so that would not make him too different. I'm not sure, you know, for both the Brexiteers and the Remainers, I've said this on the radio, I've discussed this on the radio, there are similarities between them which are much more instructive in many senses than their contrast, so they would probably both hate me to say that. And I think it's not helpful for either side to go back and sort of plunder the past as if looking for validation for the present. What happens in the present day should rest fundamentally, in my view, on the democratic mandate, which, you know, Parliament left to the people in a referendum. Now, people might like or dislike the what was delivered from that. It's not my business to say. As a historian, I'm not quite sure why views on the 17th century are supposed to illuminate the world our way in 2019. And again, as you will know, I wrote a book called Britain in Europe, in which I tried to draw it attention, both to the extent to which there is a trajectory in which you could emphasize points of similarity, and to a trajectory in which you can emphasize points of contrast. And I think that is the case. And I really think some of the material, some of the writing, I mean, I published a piece recently in which I decried the attempts in the newspaper like The Guardian by Sir Richard Evans to sort of argue that we were in some sort of, you know, position on the eve of, you know, some kind of Hitlerian takeover. I mean, he used language about Reichstag moments and things. Well, I think that's as unhelpful as it were, it would be if one was going back to look at Shakespeare. Now, ironically, of course, Shakespeare, you could say, was doing that in a sense, is if you're writing in about Richard II and putting on a play about that at the time of the Essex Conspiracy, is that intended to sort of stir up people with the comparison, or indeed is it intended to stir them up with the comparison of this is a dangerous thing to do? You know, look at the mess that came from overthrowing Richard II. I'm not sure where I would be on that. I'd be very uncomfortable about using historical analogies in order to guide the present. I think any historian is aware of complexity. Now, Shakespeare's job to offer complexity. He's offering a moral tale, and he's trying to produce a play. But as a scholar, I would always, looking at the past, draw attention to uncertainty, to plurality of views, to variety of outcomes, to the complexity of both causes, contexts, and consequences. And from that point of view, I'm very uneasy about reading from the past to the present.
And your book really emphasises that effort almost to create ambiguity, the beginning with Witches and the conclusion with Prospero. Why did you end the book with Prospero?
Oh, well, I've always thought that Prospero is a fascinating individual. Obviously, for somebody like myself, who is bookish, he is of great interest, though I don't have any magician's wand to break. I can recall that was a play I saw which very much moved me when I was a young adolescent. I was lucky enough to grow up in the outskirts of London, and to go, I'd sort of worked as a newspaper boy, and I took the money and then used that to go and see plays at two places. One, the Young Vic, which was excellent, where you could sit very close to the stage, or you had to sit very close to the stage. But the other one, I used to go to the Aldwych in the matinee, and I would buy a ticket for the very back row of the stalls, which was very inexpensive. And then when the house lights went down, I would creep forward and be able to sit really very front ways and see some absolutely tremendous productions. Prospero to me is something, you know, maybe it's a stage of life thing. It's an interesting, a very interesting character. I mean, as you know, he's now depicted in a hostile light. The standard approach to the Tempest is that this is a, you know, how awful Western imperialism is vis-a-vis the Caliban figure or the Ariel. You know, I saw the production of the Tempest in which Ariel spits in his face, you know, Ariel played by Simon Russell Bill, very good production, I ought to say. And, you know, that very much captures, again, the modern directors, if you might like to use the phrase, abuse of the plays. I actually would rather like to use that phrase. So there we are. We put it out. But to me, Prospero is a much more interesting figure because he does have issues and problems, to use modern terms, but he is fundamentally a person that uses knowledge to good intent. And I think that's very important for all of us. And, you know, this is the religious channel of the New Book Network. I would have thought people listening to that would very much understand that perception.
So we've talked about editors, we've talked about historians, we've talked about critics, we've talked a little bit about audiences. Who does Shakespeare belong to now?
Ooh. Well, that's first of all, because Shakespeare has been translated into so many languages, there is no particular reason why Shakespeare should only be seen as resonating in English culture. And indeed, many of the plays are presenting characters, Lear, for example, who are, you know, if you like to use the phrase, universal archetypes of individuals in particular circumstances who can be glimpsed widely in very different societies. What I would like to say is that one of the sadnesses of our move from being a literary culture to primarily a visual culture is that in the literary culture, Shakespeare belonged primarily to the people that read Shakespeare. Only so many people could see Shakespeare on stage. Many more people could read the plays, particularly once you have the age of mass literacy coming in the late 19th century and cheap books being produced on wood pulp paper. So there was that period in which lots and lots of people could read Shakespeare, and that was encouraged by the way in which, in the Anglophone world, Shakespeare was the basic set text for English literature. Unfortunately, in my view, others will take a different view, we are now much more in a visual age where people are more inclined to see stories in terms of film or some other visual media. And that gives much more power to the director. And I fear that that is where we are going badly wrong at the present moment. I mean, you know, I don't see quite a few Shakespeare productions. I have to say, I sometimes weary at the idiocies, and I do wish instead of being called William, you know, Hamlet by William Shakespeare, you put the director's name on and you put at the bottom, based on an idea or drawing an idea. I think that would be more helpful. And we're going back to the sort of 17th century All for Love, you know, the sort of Dryden approach. But of course, you know, when those are shown, Dryden's name is on them. I discuss that at length in my book. But the other people who changed Shakespeare, their names put on them, not Shakespeare himself. So yes, I am dismayed by what's going on at the moment.
Well, Jeremy, we've taken up a lot of your time today, and as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Before we wind up, can you tell us a little bit more about the Jane Austen book to whet our appetites for that?
Yes, I mean, I've tried to use Jane Austen's novels, her correspondence, her other writings. You know, for example, as you may know, you know, she wrote a number of prayers which have survived, and I've tried to use those in order both to throw light on her age and in particular to throw light on her. I think there's a tendency today to present Jane Austen as a writer of the Romantic period and to present her characters accordingly. Elizabeth Bennet, you know, on a peak in the Peak District, gazing into the distance as if she was a character from the Bronte sisters. But in many senses, I would argue that Jane Austen should be understood as a late 18th century writer, and I've tried to offer that account. I also have very much, you know, she was very devout personally. She was the daughter of a clergyman, of course, many clergymen in her family. One of her brothers becomes a clergyman. Many of her heroes, the trouble is most people I tend to think of the egregious cleric in Pride and Prejudice, but there are many clerics, Tilney, for example, who are heroes in her novels, and I think that they are in many senses a religious set of works, which is very interesting because they're in fiction. Just as you may know, in my book on history, I have a whole chapter on John Wesley's writings as an historian. And when people are writing in a way we don't usually tend to think about them, you can get many, many more interesting insights on them.
Well, Jeremy, thank you very much for sharing that. Look forward to seeing the book when it comes out. And thanks for coming onto the show this morning to talk about it.
I'm delighted, and I'd be more than happy to do many others for you.
Great. And thanks to everyone else for listening in. I'll see you next time on New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.